Good evening, everybody. We are the Tri-State Sports Guys, live from Norwalk, Connecticut. As Mike would say, the beautiful Norwalk, Connecticut. We will be joined by Mike in a little bit. In the meanwhile, I am joined by a coach, John Ireland. Coach, you want to say hi?
What's up?
And we're hoping to get a call from the Hoboken Studios and maybe the most talented man in all of show business, Mr. Neil Lynch. We have a great caller tonight in Scott Burrell, former UConn legend, first-round draft pick at the Charlotte Hornets, now assistant coach up at Quinnipiac University, assistant men's basketball coach. Is that Neil Lynch? Let's find out if that's Neil Lynch right now. Neil, is that you?
It's me, calling in from the work.
Oh, that is. Oh, my God. I mean, the number just shocked the both of us. Dude, how are you? The thing I thought about when I found out Mike was going to be a little delayed tonight was I have maybe the mini Minoso of online radio personalities in Neil Lynch. You're like the best pinch hitter on the earth, buddy. How's it going?
I don't mind being a Lenny Harris. You know, I'll come in and pinch hit here and there, but I'm not an everyday player, so, you know, lower the expectations a little.
Well, I spoke with our co-host a little bit ago. I said we'd hold off on a little bit of the Chris Johnson news. We'll hold off on a little Mets-Yankees talk. So I figured, Neil, we'd get into a little bit of the season's first major championship, the Masters, and then maybe you and I could break down a little bit of hockey. You know, playoffs are starting tonight. It's the best time of the year. So let's start at Augusta National. First thing I want to know, Neil, how much of this tournament did you watch? That's the first thing I want to know because the numbers were at a 10-year low. How much did Neil Lynch watch out at Hoboken?
I like to say that I contributed to the low rating. I didn't watch – I watched mainly the home stretch, you know, because I think some people were interested in seeing Jordan Spieth take the green jacket. But, I mean, I'm cool with Bubba winning. It's just interesting because, you know, Tiger has the injury. Phil misses the cut for the first time in, like, 17 years. And you're looking at a field that – I mean, I was hard-pressed to come up with, like, a handful of golfers that I really knew, you know, outside of maybe Ricky Fowler. You know, it's just, you know, that's not my sport to really follow, and so at least someone I knew won.
You know, I think that what would have made an interesting storyline, and again, if you tuned in for the back nine, I mean, it really was one of the more kind of banal back nines I can remember seeing at Augusta. I think the storyline that probably a lot of people were hoping for was could Freddie Couples make a run? You know, he's got, I think it's five straight top 15s there. You know, he didn't play a great Sunday round. Or could the 50-year-old Miguel Angel Jimenez make a run? And, you know, he shot a great, I think it was 67 on Saturday to get himself into contention. But the thing that I was struck by was the way in which Watson looked as though he just manhandled that course as much as I can ever remember for a guy who only won by three strokes. I mean, his tee shot on 13, Jordan Spieth said he'll never forget that as long as he lives. I mean, it was a 350-yard drive on a par five, giving him a lob wedge into the green, eventual two-putt birdie. And for a guy to win by three shots, it was as impressive to me as when McIlroy won at Kiowa by eight and when he won the U.S. Open at Congressional by the same score, eight shots. Did you find it that way, Neil, watching that back nine? Did you think, like, my goodness, this is a guy who's just, he's three shots ahead, but it felt like 10. Like, after that four-shot swing on 8 and 9, it was as though this guy was the only guy on the course.
Yeah, I kind of got that sense, and you can get the sense that no matter, you know, how well a lot of the other players were coming down the final stretch, that Bubba just had it. You know, whatever it was. I mean, I know the Spieth or Spieth, whatever you want to pronounce it, he holed out on a bunker and, you know, looked like he was heading strong. But, you know, I think it was just Bubba really kind of added to the anticlimactic nature. It's just like his demeanor and the way that he was, it seemed like his confidence just really, you know, it took any kind of anxiety out of who was going to win this tournament.
Yeah, you know, before we get to Spieth a little bit, because I do want to touch on that topic of a 20-year-old finishing tied second, but where does two green jackets in your mind, when you start to look at the history of the game, because, you know, I saw an interesting fact that he's the fourth guy right now under the age of 50 with multiple green jackets, obviously Woods and Mickelson and Jose Maria Olazabal. So now, I mean, he's in pretty heady company now. I mean, everybody with three majors is in the Hall of Fame. Bubba Watson only has 6 tour wins. He's 35. But 2 of them are green jackets. I mean, this guy gets one more major. And if you go by, you know, the past, the way the PGA Tour has done it, you're talking about a Hall of Famer here. I mean, does this guy strike you? Because you know what? I was thinking on Sunday watching it. Everybody's telling me about Carlos Beltran being a Hall of Famer, right? And then you look at his numbers and you go, my God, he kind of is getting close, but he never has seemed like it. You know, and I thought, here's Watson one major away from being a bona fide Hall of Famer. Does he strike you like that, Neil, or do you just figure like he's got these two masters and that's it, he's going to peter out like a Bernard Langer or something like that?
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of people out there that kind of want him to fall into the mold of Phil Mickelson. You know, he's kind of had that likable guy that comes up with great shots from time to time. So, you know, I think that he's got a following, and if he can continue to play like he does, you know, at the Masters, then he certainly has got a shot. You know, and he's got a lot of golf ahead of him. I don't think that he's the, you know, unless I'm wrong, I don't think he's the kind of guy that bows out and misses the cut or gets injured a lot. So, you know, if he can remain somewhat consistent, you know, he could be the heir apparent to Mickelson.
You know, they're saying that, you know, after he won in 2012 in that playoff of Louis Oosthuizen, you know, he kind of had a little dip in his performance. They went out to San Fran for the U.S. Open, and he cried and moaned about the course and, you know, at Olympic Club, and that's when Webb Simpson won. He goes over to the Open Championship. He doesn't typically play well. I don't know if it's the high ball flight in the wind or, you know, whatever it is, but you're talking about here a guy who's had a lifetime pass now at Augusta. You know, obviously had it since 2012. So he's going to have a bevy of chances just on that course, just on that one course every single year until he decides he wants to stop playing. I can't see any situation where he doesn't put at least one more four-day set together at Augusta National and win another green jacket. I mean, a buddy of mine texted me saying, you know, why is he crying? Why is he doing this? You know, he comes from modest means. You know, both of his parents worked multiple jobs. I believe his dad was a Vietnam veteran. I mean, you're talking about a guy who comes from a blue-collar background who's got two green jackets just sitting in his closet. I mean, there's a lot of great golfers that never won a green jacket. I mean, there's guys in the Hall of Fame that never got to that mountaintop, and here he is. He's just sitting there, blue-collar guy, Baghdad, Florida, you know, talks with a little bit of a southern twang or whatever the hell that is, and he's just winning multiple green jackets. That's all this guy does now is win majors. It's like, astonishing to me that people are worried about whether or not he's going to win another one of the three majors. If he just wins another green jacket, he's going straight into the Hall of Fame, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, you look at the rest of the field, it's not like there's, you know, a lot of competition. Tiger is obviously on the decline. Phil is obviously off his game. So I think now is the opportunity for him to kind of take the throne, if you will, and, you know, just, you know, piggybacking on what you're saying about him being blue-collar, the dude went, he celebrated his victory at Waffle House, which is classic. I love Waffle House, and it's, you know, it's like the poor man's IHOP, and, you know, how do you not love that?
Yeah, you know, I'm getting into Twitter a little bit now, following some people, and he is one of the guys I follow, and when I looked at my Twitter feed Sunday night and saw a picture of he, his wife, and I believe it was his caddy and a couple other guys I didn't recognize, at a friggin' Waffle House. I mean, that is, because, I mean, if I, you know, dude, if I was ever able to win the Masters, I would just want, like, a nice chicken parm from Stanford Restaurant or something like that. Like, just something simple. I'm not a big frills guy, you know what I mean? And to look at him and go, and I saw his appearance yesterday on Morning Drive on the Golf Channel, and he goes, you know, they threw a big fancy dinner at Augusta National that night for the champion, right? And he goes, it's just a lot of fancy food, and I just wanted to go get something simple. I mean, that's what you're dealing with, a guy now who just wins majors and wants Waffle House. I mean, talk to that. You know, I mean, is that cool or is that not cool? Come on.
Yeah, I'm totally in agreement with you. I mean, he's got a cool name. I mean, everything about him has been, you know, the makings of a movie. You know, the story that he's got going on. And the fact that he gets so emotional, you know, I was hoping to see a little more emotion out of him after he won. I mean, I know he kind of thought he had it in the bag and maybe he was just spent, you know, from all the adrenaline. But I was kind of hoping for a little bit more, you know, one of those iconic moments that you can, you know, capture in a photo and you can use down the line. But, you know, that's just the kind of guy he is. He's just, like, he seems like a pretty humble dude who just goes about business. And, you know, I think a lot of people can appreciate that.
Well, he said yesterday on the Golf Channel that he talked to his caddy right before he hit his approach shot in 18, and he said he'd always had a dream of having a cushiony lead walking up the 18th fairway in Augusta, and he wanted to walk down past the patrons of the gallery, the fans, whatever you want to call them, and high-five everyone, and his caddy talked him out of it. Would he have gotten bonus points with Neil Lynch if he walked up the 18th fairway before he ever even holds out? And he just starts high-fiving all the patrons. Would that have brought it up a notch for you, or you wanted to see him, like, just go completely ballistic when he won and go nuts?
To me, when I think about, you know, golf victories and you know, moments that come out of it, you know, the Tiger Woods fist pump back when, before he was an adulterer, I guess, you know, was something that, you know, kind of stuck in my mind. You know, it's just the little things that you know, you hold on to and you cherish and you know, really tax on to your legacy. You know, for Bubba, it seems a little out of character and uncharacteristic, you know, for him to go ballistic. But, you know, I just, you know, is this one of those times, like, 5 years, 10 years down the road where we'll say, hey, remember that Masters when Bubba Watson did what? You know, it's kind of a sad, you know, postscript to this, but, you know, maybe this is setting up the chips for setting the table for next year, where maybe Tiger comes back and Phil comes back and it's a three-way race instead of that two-headed monster that we're so used to seeing.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the most interesting things in sports, and I've thought this for as long as I can remember, is when you're seeing greatness and you know it's happening while you're watching it. Like, you don't look back in hindsight and say, boy, Jack Nicklaus was good. But, like, my dad talks about him and older guys I know and say, you know, you knew when this guy had two or three majors. You're like, he is impressive. Now, I know Jack was a lot younger, and I'm not in any way putting Bubba Watson in this category. But I just get the feeling that I'm not going to take anything away from Bubba, but I think the U.S. Open with kind of his swashbuckling style is a bit of a stretch a la Mickelson. I think the Open Championship, and I never thought Mickelson would win it, so maybe I'm wrong, but I think the high ball flight that Bubba plays in the winds over there in the UK might be tough. But I think someplace like the PGA this year at Valhalla, which kind of sets up a little bit similar to Augusta National, could be something he could do. And, you know, if he ever bucks it back, this second Masters win with any of the three, but the PGA sets up well for him. And like I said, a lifetime's worth of opportunities back at Augusta National. And you're talking about a guy who, if he can pluck one more major, he joins the likes of, you know, Billy Casper, Patrick Harrington, Vijay Singh, Kerry Middlecoff, all guys that won three majors, all guys that are enshrined in the Hall of Fame. And I got the feeling on Sunday watching him that just in my mind, I'm like, I know I'm watching something special here, even though the back nine was kind of bland. I mean, there was nobody really making a charge at him, and you kind of knew Spieth kind of took himself out of contention with the back-to-back bogeys there on 8 and 9 and Bubba birdies both, and there's the four-shot swing, and he said, okay, he's only three behind, but he ain't winning. So, to me, I'm watching Bubba going, he's going to get a second green jacket, go into this lofty realm of the greats in the golf to win twice there, and now he's got all these chances. I mean, do you think, Neil, that he doesn't repeat that trend of 2012 where he kind of plays flat and you're going to see good golf from him the rest of this year?
Well, there's always that, you know, that kind of hangover that a lot of teams or players or athletes get after winning a big, you know, title like this. So, you know, it's to be expected that, you know, I don't know that he can maintain that same level of play heading into the, you know, the next few Opens. But, you know, it's a situation where it's like, who's going to step up and compete, you know? I mean, like, at least from the American side, you know, what was the stat that Watson was like the fourth American in the last 15 years to win the Masters? You know, so I think it's more of a win for the Americans than anything else. And you hope to see that, you know, that the Americans can kind of, I guess, keep the momentum going. You know, I'd like to see, to me, it seems like Jordan Spieth could be, you know, a young guy that golf can latch on to and really market, you know, if he can continue to play like he did in Augusta. I think he's a huge, you know, young guy, 20 years old. That's like a big-time opportunity to kind of escort in a new era, if you will, for golf. You know, I wouldn't say icons, but, you know, players that you can get excited about that, you know, are going to come in and play hard each time out.
Well, I think, you know, with Spieth, I think if you put Bubba to the side for a second, Spieth for me was the real takeaway from the tournament, because I alluded to it before, you know, you get a little tired of watching Freddie Couples and you go, you know, he got his one major, he makes these charges, but he's, you know, he's 54 now. Jimenez is a guy I've always liked, but you know, okay, that's not anything really important. But Spieth is a young guy here who has a good head on his shoulders. Forget the game that he has, because he does have an ample game. He hits the ball a mile. It just looks short because he's playing with Bubba on Sunday. But, you know, he hits it a mile. He picks up on those greens pretty well for a guy in his first attempt on the very difficult greens there at Augusta. And, you know, I just hope he doesn't get chewed up in this media machine where they expect him to have two majors by the time he's McIlroy paid, which I think is 4 years from now. Or, you know, he's got to win young like Tiger did, or he's got to do this or he's got to do that. Because the bottom line is, if the kid wins 3, 4, 5 majors, he's the legend of the game. And if he could become like uber great and win 8, 9, 10, I mean, you get up there with like Gary Player and Tom Watson. So I just think the kid needs to make sure he keeps the people in his corner that are kind of guiding him down the right path, because he seems like everything's right about him. You know, he doesn't seem like he has any red flags that go up when you talk about him. I just hope he doesn't get chewed up and spit out, because that's what it seemed like for me for a while with Ricky Fowler. And then you see Fowler in contention this week. But I just felt like people got on him and the pressure kind of, you know, he succumbed to it a little bit. Now he's with Butch Harmon, his game seems better. But Spieth, to me, I just hope, because I think you'll see really big things out of him. I think you'll see things like you do with McIlroy, but I just hope people don't hold him up to that microscope, because I think that could be detrimental to his career. Do you agree with that, Neil? Or do you think he has the mindset, do whatever he keeps doing, he doesn't need anybody to help him any which way? Or what are your feelings on him in terms of what you saw this weekend?
Well, I mean, he's got the makings, you know. I don't think this was a fluke. And, you know, it's not – I mean, he doesn't have to think – I mean, obviously he wants to win, but I think it's more of just hanging around and being a competitor and being a challenger and being in the running. I think, you know, that's where – how he gets the more TV time and more recognition and you know – ensures that people take notice is doing what he did here, but, you know, making sure that he's on the leaderboard in that first page. You know, I think that's basically a realistic goal, and if he can continue to do that, then he'll become a household name.
You know, I think one of the biggest things with him is the fact that he's won. I mean, he's won on tour now. I know that there's two different sides of that. There's tour events and there's major championships, but watching him last year at the John Deere, I mean, you're talking about a kid who was 700 something in 700 and change in the FedEx Cup points, that he vaults to 11th with that win. He gets the plane right over to the Open Championship at Muirfield. And, you know, I mean, he has a win under his belt. Now he's got a major championship performance under his belt where he goes, you know, the hell with the rest of these guys. I'm just as good as they are. I don't care if I'm 20 or not. And the other thing I want to say, and I'd like to get your opinion on it, I heard some people kind of bemoaning him for, I don't know what if he was being a little bit ostentatious with his reactions to some of the shots that he hit. And I would say to anybody out there that's critical of him when he kind of smashed his club into the ground and he hit his putter and whatever, what were you doing at 20? I mean, the people that were critical of him, where were you at 20, and how would you have performed at Augusta National? Because you know what, I'm a hack golfer, and I throw clubs and smash them. This kid's world class. And when he hits a bad shot, I don't blame him for being a little ticked off about it. But I heard a lot of people say, like, you know, he's got to button it up a little bit. Like, shut up. Seriously, shut up. Let the kid play. He's got a little, you know, anger issue. So does Tiger. I've seen Phil get mad. You know, Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer used to get mad. Do you have any problem, Neil, with a 20-year-old kid snapping a club, banging something, hitting his putter with his hand because he's a little ticked off about a bad shot or a bad putt that he hit?
No, I mean, obviously it's dependent on the situation, but if it's a big shot or if it's something that he thinks he should have hit and he gets a little riled up over it, I have no issue with that. It's, you know, is he abusing his caddy? Is he treating his caddy badly? Is he mouthing off the fans? Is he, like, you know, is he basically pulling a Billy Madison and, like, you know, running roughshod over the course and making a mockery of the game? No. You know, if anything, golf needs a little more energy and a little more excitement in terms of emotion. You know, and I'm all for that. I guess it's maybe the more conservative traditionalists or guys that, you know, are hoping to keep golf in the Stone Age that, you know, don't appreciate when he, you know, reacts. And, you know, you're going to do that when you're 20. I mean, you know, I don't know that Tiger really did it when he was that age, but Tiger's a whole other beast. So, if anything, you know, can he keep it under wraps? Sure. Is it something that, you know, is holding him back? Possibly, because, you know, as an athlete or as in any position like that, you need to be able to forget and move on. But, you know, considering there's only room to go up at this point. He has so much potential. It's pretty much, he's not on the twilight of his career. He's only starting. So, I mean, if that's the one knock on him is that he gets a little too emotional, I'll take that back.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And, you know, I just want to say one last thing. I mean, Tom Weisskopf was a guy who won an Open Championship in the 70s and by his own admission said that his temper, and I've heard Jack Nicklaus say it, had Weisskopf not had a crazy temper, he could have probably won four or five majors, but it kind of derailed his career. I don't see that with Spieth. I see it in terms along the lines without the same kind of talent that Tiger had at 2021. I think it's just a driving force for him. I just think he has high expectations of himself. But before we go to a quick break, Neil, I just want a quick question for you. If you had to pick who's going to have a better U.S. Open in June, are you going to go with Bubba Watson or are you going to go with Jordan Spieth?
Cool. Yeah, I mean, you know, Spieth to me was an unknown, you know. So, I mean, I kind of just picked up on him, you know, this weekend. So, but, yeah, I mean, as far as that goes, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if Jordan is able to sneak up and edge out Bubba. I don't want to get too high on the kid because, you know, it's still a little early for me at least. I haven't seen enough of him to make a judgment. But and you can't discount Bubba's veteran status. The guy's been in the game for so long and has seen the ups and downs. So I don't want to go there yet. But, you know, I mean, if this is what the true Jordan looks like and how he plays, then, you know, I'm all for it.
Yep, I agree with you 100%. I'm taking Bubba for the better U.S. Open. I'm taking Jordan for more career majors. We are going to take a quick commercial break. And, Mr. Lynch, when we come back, we're going to get into a little bit of hockey, mainly Rangers, Flyers, because you had a great hockey article the other day about the Devils. So I'm going to test you, see what you got going on in your mind about the Devil, the Rangers and the Flyers. We will be right back with the Tri-State Sports Guys.
Is anyone out there? This is the Nathaniel County Sheriff's Office. Is anyone out there? We were surrounded by the dead. They were in rioters, we were told. We have survivors here. Civilians, women, children. Is anyone out there?
Follow the story in the Ragnarok Rising Saga by D.A. Roberts. Available on Amazon, Smashwords, Barnes & Noble, and BooksAMillion.com. Visit RagnarokRising.Weebly.com.
We are back. with the Tri-State Sports guys. We got a little Ragnarok out of our system, so everybody's feeling good here. Before we get into hockey, or maybe this is a hockey call, we're going to go out to the 22 number hotline real quick. You're on with the Tri-State Sports guys. Who's this?
Hey, what's up, Santa?
Who's this?
Neil Scully.
Oh, what's up, man?
What's up, man? How are you?
I'm fantastic. What do you got for us tonight, bud?
I got a couple funny stories just to follow up, not to end your golf talk already. So when I got your email and say, hey, let's try to get somebody with golf or hockey, right? So the first person I reach out to is Bubba Watson. So I go and I get Bubba Watson's agent on the phone. And he says to me, Bubba is not taking any more in media whatsoever. I said, hey, listen, I understand. Now, the agent says to me, he says, look, you don't understand what happened. They were supposed to leave the next night, the next day after the Masters. And now that he won the Masters, he has to go on this media tour. So him and his family are all pissed off right now. Here's this guy, he goes and he books this vacation, and I'm not thinking that he's going to win the Masters, and now his family's all pissed off at him, and so he had to crunch this media thing in within 2 days. So Hold on.
His family is ticked off that he won the Masters?
His family's pissed off because they were supposed to go on to the vacation that Monday.
Did they see the winner's check?
The whole thing was, Dan, that I said to the agent, and the agent was just kind of annoyed by the whole thing. I said, did he not think that he had a chance into the Masters? And he goes, Bubba doesn't operate that way. I mean, he literally booked a vacation for that Monday right after.
Well, I got to say this. I'm pretty sure I speak for everybody involved with the show. I'd rather win the Masters than go to Bora Bora. There's so much more that comes with that. I don't understand.
Well,
I understand your little myth about it. Go ahead.
No. What I was going to say is I think more in the lines of the fact that he has to do this media tour now, which was something that he didn't anticipate.
Come on here and just answer a couple softballs. I just want to know how cool is it to win a team jacket. That's all I want to know. And then he can hang up.
We'll get him on.
Bolano, wherever he's coming. Yeah, I mean, that's great. I would love to talk to that guy.
So the second guy, I'm going to ask for your help to pronounce his name, is Jonah Blixt.
Jonas Blixt, yep.
So he's from Sweden. He's from Sweden, right? And so I get in touch with his agent. Now, his agent is this guy that is, and probably in the 6-7 months that I've been involved with this thing, his agent is probably one of the more cool dudes. He lives on the beach in San Diego. So I get in touch with him, and so he starts, talking to me about, just normal BS stuff. And he says, you want, Jonas to call in? And I said, that would be great. We want to talk and we want to get sort of an inside perspective of what it's going to be like to be on the green. And, did you think you were going to win? And, the whole spiel I do. So he says, that would be great. So then he starts talking to me a little bit more, talks to me a little bit about New York because he saw the New York number and, just like a typical San Diego dude, right? So he ends the conversation. He goes, I don't think Jonas is going to call in. And I said, why? He says, pretty much every Swedish, media network has been trying to get in touch with him since the Masters, and he won't talk to anybody. So I said, all right, we'll give him a shot, So the guy calls me this morning, and he's like, nah, he doesn't want to talk to anybody. He just doesn't want to. He just wants to play golf. So anyway, that's what happened with him. And then the third guy, which was Jordan. So I talked to this guy. Jordan's agent is a guy who's based out of Dallas. Now, this guy's agent was a big, big time at one of the bigger agencies out there, probably if not the biggest agency out there. So it was a French agency that wanted to have a North American presence. So they hired this guy. So this French company hired this guy from one of the biggest agencies out there, right? And so now he goes and he just starts obtaining all this different talent, and Jordan happens to be one of them. So I had to go and do like a fake name and profile to get in touch with the guy. And basically the guy says it's been nonstop left and right from a marketing standpoint. It has nothing really too much to do with the Masters, the fact that he did well at the Masters, if he's had in on this. Jordan, it's almost like advertisers or marketers are looking to replace Tiger with this kid, Jordan. That's how much they believe in this guy.
Well, I mean, that's all nice and sweet. I like Jordan. I'm as big a Jordan Spieth fan as anybody, but I don't see him replacing Tiger. I don't see anyone replacing Tiger, to be honest. It's just evidenced by the fact that Tiger's making like five times the money McIlroy's making from Nike. Spieth has a long road to hoe here. I mean, you know, he seems like a nice kid. He's got the respect. I mean, I saw him on the green talking with major winners like Crenshaw and Tom Watson before the match started. So in terms of Blicks, you know, he seems like another nice guy. I know he's a party guy. You know, I love to have a good time. So maybe one day he'll win a major and we can get him to call in. But you just keep doing that yeoman's work, Matty, because you do great stuff, bud.
All right, brother. Listen, be good, man. I'll talk to you guys soon, all right? Take care, Neil.
All right, thank you, man.
Yeah.
You, Neil, everybody loves us. I mean, what else could we do? Our producer loves us. I mean, you know, we got fans all over the place, bud.
I'm disappointed that he didn't try to get John Daly on the show. I'm disappointed.
Because he's drinking how many Diet Cokes? 28.
Well, he was doing 28, and now he's down to a more admirable 12 or 16. So, Godspeed, John Daly.
Neil, this is Sean here. Did you hear, I read a thing, I didn't know if it was one of those fake articles or not. Did you hear that John Daly was he was promoting something at a Hooters, like a mile and a half down the road from Augusta?
Yeah, he was, I think he was trying to like sell stuff at the tourney, I think.
I'm sorry if I just took away one of the dude, are you serious things, but like I read that, and again, you're one of the first people I think of.
Yeah, I mean, it's the fact that me and John have not hung out yet is a travesty, and we got to hook that up somehow, because, I mean, the world would implode.
I mean, first of all, he's one of my favorite golfers of all time, and there's a guy who's won two majors, never on a Ryder Cup. He's persona non grata, I guess, because of the alcoholism and the off-course stuff. He's just a great guy, and I think if he came on the show, he would trump any other guest we've had outside of Ernie Banks. Would you disagree with that, Neil? I mean, outside of Ernie, would John Daly not be the best guest we've ever had?
For sure. I mean, you know, we could do a whole show with him, just regaling tales of his life on the road and, like, what he's come across. And can you imagine what he's seen and touched and felt and heard and smelled in his lifetime? Just the experiences the guy has gone through. But we'll just—it's enough for a trilogy, at least at the box office.
Yeah, and by the way, Coach Ireland just mentioned to me, as I said, second best guest we've ever had. I forgot about the unequal, unrivaled Jerry Rice. So my apologies to Mr. Rice. But Neil, can I be honest for a sec? Can we get to a little hockey before Mike comes back? Can we do that? Because I feel like we're doing something dirty behind his back here by doing the hockey, and I don't want him to be here. I don't want him to be around for the hockey. So I want to know, do you want to start? You want to start with the Rangers and Flyers, or do you want to maybe move around, give some quick picks on the other series or anything you want to talk about other than the Rangers and Flyers, or do you just want to jump right into that?
I mean, yeah, that's let's just delve right into it, you know, because, I mean, there are only, like, maybe one or two other series in the opening round that I'm excited about.
Yeah, what's the other series, though? I just want to know that first, and then we'll talk Rangers-Flyers.
I mean, you want to talk about, I mean, outside of the Rangers-Flyers, you want to talk about series that I care about and that I think will be really intense just from a historical standpoint. It's got to be Bruins-Red Wings, right? I mean, that's got to be up there, considering, you know, the Red Wings are now in the 22nd, 23rd straight postseason appearance. Bruins are coming off a Stanley Cup. They're looking pretty tight going into the postseason. And the other series that I had my eye on that I've heard good things about is the Blues and Blackhawks. I've heard some rumblings
Absolutely.
About how how the Blues might have something up their sleeve. So I don't know. Whatever you want to start with, I'll chime in when I can.
Well, I think we'd be remiss not to start with the only local team to make the playoffs. And, you know, that's bad news for guys like us because we're Islanders and Devils fans. But I think we should start with the Rangers and Flyers, and I'm going to give you my 2 cents on it. The word I'm going to use to describe why I like the Flyers in this series, and it is not – the words are not anti-Rangers fans. It is toughness. And it's the hallmark of most Flyers teams, even post-Broad Street Bullies days. This is a team that can come at you with Wayne Simmonds, Sean Couturier, Downey, Braden Coburn on the blue line. Steve Mason, I think, is one of the more underrated goaltenders, certainly in the Eastern Conference. He's had a very good season with kind of a transient defensive core. They've had some injuries and some trades when they picked up AMAC from the Islanders. But I think it's a team that this is a perfect first-round matchup for them because the Rangers have looked, the only word to really use is soft, at a lot of points during the season. And I can't really look at one line because, you know, if you look at Carcillo and say that that's your grinder, I can't see him playing big minutes in the playoffs. He really never has in the past. So I don't know what line you use if you're the Rangers up front to combat what the Flyers can bring in terms of just toughness and grit. And I don't know which defenseman can really stand up to the onslaught of that Flyers forecheck. The one X factor I see for the Rangers, of course, would be Lundqvist, because if he plays at his best, the Rangers win the series. I mean, he's the one guy that can offset what the Flyers can do. But I do like the Flyers for all the reasons I mentioned. You have Claude Giroux, who's been one of the best players in the league since January. I mean, he was struggling early on. People wanted to rip the C off his chest and all these other things. Now he's playing great. So I do like the Flyers in this series just because of how tough they are. They come at you in waves. There's no one guy they're relying on. Their defensemen move the puck. And I think Mason plays well behind that whole group. So what do you think, Neil?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I think Lundqvist is going to have to stand on his head the entire series for the Rangers to really pull this out. It's kind of odd that the Rangers get the 5 and the Flyers get the 6. I think it's attributed to the whole new playoff system and how they're ranking stuff. But, yeah, I don't get the sense, at least from what Boomer says on Boomer and Carton, that the Rangers really have that kind of attitude that can stand up to what the Flyers bring to the table. And it's just, it's crazy to think that the Flyers started off 0-3 and had to fire their head coach and assistant coach, and now they're kind of in the driver's seat, if you will. You know, talking about who they might be going up against. You know, obviously, it's going to be a long road to hoe, but I mean, from what I've heard. But who knows? I mean, the Rangers could come out and surprise you. I mean, it's one of those teams where they're kind of, I don't know, if inconsistent is the right word, but, you know, it seems like they don't have the kind of go-to guy on each line that you're saying with the Flyers that have the depth. So, you know, I think King Henry is just going to have to step it up and put on a show.
Yeah, I think the Flyers are going to come at them in waves. The Flyers have some big bodies. I mean, Wayne Simmonds is a guy that I've really liked for quite a few years now. I love Couturier. I mentioned Downey. I mean, Matt Reed on the blue line, they've got big guys. And one of the things, and I mentioned it to you, Mike, a few weeks ago, that troubles me about the Rangers is that first pass out of their defensive zone into the breakout is never quite just what you want to see if you're a Rangers fan. And now you're going to have a Flyers team that is going to forecheck like demons, and they're going to come at you hard, and they're going to hit everything that moves for however many games that series goes. And that doesn't really benefit the Rangers, in my opinion, a team that, especially since the San Luis trade, they're trying to play like a prettier style, and it just doesn't really suit the kind of personnel that they have. I mean, you have McDonough, who's a good offensive defenseman, but I don't know what you look for from Staal and Girardi in the breakout game. Those guys, they're not stay-at-home defense, but they're more grounded. So, I mean, you look for Strowman to make some plays. I just worry about them there. And I worry about Lundqvist with the sustained pressure that the Flyers can keep down in that end of the ice. I mean, that's just the way I'm looking at it. So I'm going to take the Flyers in six games. Thoughts?
Yeah, I like it. I mean, you know, I hate to see Philly win at all, ever, but it's kind of hard to get in New York's corner. Unless, you know, the key to their success in the past was, at least when I saw them play, was the fact that they were just blocking shots like crazy. They had guys getting in the way of the puck and deflecting the puck and just making it impossible for the puck to make its way to the net. So maybe if they can get back to that kind of style of play where not a lot of shots are making it to Henrique, you know, maybe they got a shot. You know, Brian Boyle, is he something to consider, a dark horse, a wild card, if you will? You know, is St. Louis going to be a factor? Bring any kind of veteran savvy to that squad in the playoffs? You know, I just Callahan, is he a guy that can, you know, make some moves? I don't know. I just don't see it. I you know, I prefer New York over Philly, but I got to take Philly as well. But I'm hoping it goes seven.
Yeah, if it went seven, I mean, they're always great in the playoffs. But let's move around the league here quickly. We can just give some quick picks, our takes on things. I'm going to start with the top dogs in the East, the Boston Bruins. They're playing the Detroit Red Wings. I believe that series starts Friday. I've been high on the Bruins, and I know I'm not going on a limb with that. They've been, to me, leaps and bounds ahead of any other team in the league. Forget the Eastern Conference. Love the big bodies. Love the defensive core. I think a guy like Krug is a real playmaker back there to complement guys like Seidenberg and Chara. Love Tuukka Rask. I think he's the Vezina winner. You never want to shortchange the Wings. I know they've got some injury issues with Zetterberg and Datsyuk going through some things. They've been banged up all year. They are the Detroit Red Wings. They're the best-run franchise in hockey, in my opinion. But I'm going to take the Bruins in six, and I heard a lot of people, including Barry Melrose, saying he likes the Bees in four. I'm taking the Bees in six.
I'm going to go one game better and say the Bees in five. You know, I think the Red Wings can pull out a win at home. But, you know, I want to see the Bruins absolutely dismantle Detroit. I don't want to even have it be a contest, although, you know, it's two-story franchises, two of the original six. I mean, I have no love for Detroit after what they did to my New Jersey Devils.
All right. Let's go Tampa Bay, Montreal. Tampa Bay is a two seed. Montreal is a three. I'm taking Montreal. They were my Stanley Cup pick at the beginning of the season. They haven't performed quite up to those standards. But I love Carey Price. It's another team. They have a ton of speed up front. The defensive core is not the greatest thing you want to see, but I love Price, love the speed up front, and I think Tampa Bay is a team that relies too much on that neutral zone trap and all the little things they do through the neutral zone. That Montreal does have some big bodies, that they will chip it in. They will play a gritty game. I'm taking Montreal in that series, again, six games.
Yeah, I mean – sure, why not? I mean, I don't see how Tampa can compete, really. I mean, well, you know what? No, I'm going to take Tampa on this one. Yeah, I think Montreal, despite what you said, that the Lightning have got to catch something in a bottle, if you will.
Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh-Columbus, I think it's the one Debbie Downer of the whole first round. Columbus is a tough little group. They play hard. I love what Dubinsky's done since he's gone there. I just don't see it with them. I think Pittsburgh's just another team, kind of like the Bruins. They're going to come at you in waves, although they're not as big as Boston. They do play a tough game. It's the one series I really have down as a sweep. I think Pittsburgh has a real good shot of winning every one of those games by multiple goals. So that's my pick. I'm taking Pittsburgh in the sweep over the Jackets. What do you got, Neil?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's going to be one game in there where Columbus sticks it to them and gives them a ride for their money. Yeah, it's a clean sweep for Pittsburgh.
All right, well, before we just go to the West quickly, who do you have coming out of the East? If you had to pick one team, I'm taking the Bruins. It's chalk. I'm probably going to be wrong, but I just think the Bruins have too much for everybody in the East.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it looks like it's going to be honestly think it's going to look like a repeat of last year. I think you're going to have, Pittsburgh and Boston squaring up, and I don't know that you can ask for anything better than that.
No, I agree. I think it's the marquee matchup in the East. Going out west, I got my upset special here for the first round. I actually like Minnesota over Colorado. I love everything Colorado's done this year. I'm a huge Gabriel Landeskog fan. He's a tough-nosed guy. I love everything he does. He's the captain out there in Denver. But I love the way Minnesota's been playing, and they have three goalies they can throw at you. All have played pretty well. Obviously, my boy Josh Harding. Love Mikko Koivu. Love Zach Parise. Suter on the back line. I'm taking Minnesota in that series in seven. I think that's got the best chance of being a good series by a long shot of any of the 1-4 matchups. What do you think about that one, Neil?
Yeah, you know, it's definitely a possibility. I still cringe when I see Parise in a Wild uniform. I think that was a really major blow to the Devils, and you know, with there was actually I saw there was a drinking game that someone had created, and they said every time that Danny Heatley scores a goal, you get this scream 50-07, and then chug your beer or shotgun your beer, if you will. So maybe Danny Heatley turns it around and gets back to his 50 goal ways.
I tell you, he's a hell of a sniper, so I wouldn't put it past him. I think there's a couple. I think San Jose and Los Angeles is a good series too, but the St. Louis Chicago series. The first thing that worries me about the Hawks. And I love the Hawks, but you're not quite sure with Kane and Taves. I mean, they've sat out a bunch of games. They both had some different, you know, they list them as upper body and lower body injuries. They've been nicked up. St. Louis, since the Ryan Miller acquisition from Buffalo, to me, looks like the Boston Bruins of the West. I mean, they just have toughness, and that's what you're looking for in the playoffs. And then, you know, the Oshie injury might hurt a little bit. You know, he's a great player. He's a first-line skater for them. But just something tells me that the banged-up Hawks lose in six to the Blues, and I will not be upset to be wrong because I don't like anything about St. Louis. Give me your thoughts on that one, Neil.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is not the time to be the walking wounded. So I got to think that you got to go with the team with the healthier squad. St. Louis head to head, St. Louis won the regular season series 3-2. But if you look at it, they won two overtimes, and then the last two games, Chicago won not handedly, but it wasn't as close as the score indicates. So, I want to say Chicago gutsy hockey and gets it to six, but I think St. Louis in six.
Well, you're with me, buddy, so I like it. So let's go with the Ducks and Stars. I don't think the Stars have the depth to compete in that series. I've liked Anaheim all year. Love Jonas Hiller and net. Ryan Getzlaf, one of my favorite players. I'm going with the Ducks in five. The Stars are a group that play hard. Just don't think they have a third and fourth line depth you need, and I don't think they have a second or third defensive pair. So give me your thoughts on that, Neil.
I'm kind of pulling for Timo Solani on this one, the 43-year-old. I kind of want to see him, advance. But then again, it would be pretty sweet to see how Tyler Seguin celebrates after an opening round victory. I really had no interest in this whatsoever. I don't know what it is about the two teams, but it just there's nothing that tickles my fancy about this one. But if I had to go with a team, I'll pull for the Ducks. Ducks.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that series has the best chance of being just a stinker. I just think the Ducks are too big, too strong, too fast. The goaltending's too good. But to go to a series that should not be a stinker, right, and it's a great rivalry with the Ducks, the Sharks and the Kings. The Sharks interest me because they're like the Cubs of hockey. They fall apart when it matters. Joe Thornton gets the worst label in hockey as just the big jumbo Joe who can't win. Antti Niemi is a goaltender with Stanley Cup winning experience with the Hawks. And this kid, Alex Stalock, is legit, and he plays a lot for this team. I think this is the year that the Sharks either put up or shut up. I think this is the year with some expiring contracts where they either have to do something or you just blow up the whole franchise and start over. So with that in mind, as much as I love the way the Kings play, I'm taking the Sharks here. I think it's a seven-game series. I love their depth, and I love Braun up front. I love him. I love Joe Pavelski. And I think this is finally the time where Thornton and Marlowe get over that hump and make a real push towards getting the Stanley Cup Finals. Give me your thoughts on San Jose and L.A.
Yeah, it's crazy. It always seems like people are high on the Sharks every time, and they seem to disappoint every time. I don't know what it is. The fact that they've, kept Thornton and Marlowe so productive at the age of 34, it just seems like they have the right combination. But again, it's the Kings. That's what sucks. It's like the Kings always seem to, find a way. And, if there's one team I absolutely, outside of maybe the Flyers, I absolutely don't want to see advancing, it's the Kings. So I'm going to be putting some serious juju against them. And I would like to see the Sharks take it to them and take it to them hard in five.
Yeah, like I said, I think it's going to be a great series. I really do. I think the Kings have too much fight. I just think that there comes a point, and, Thornton's our age, and Thornton's been the guy who falls apart. He's like the Mark Teixeira of the NHL Stanley Cup playoffs. I mean, he puts up these ungodly numbers when he's good, and then he stinks it up when he's not, and then he takes all the blame for the Sharks. He took all the blame in Boston. I've never understood it. But who do you like coming out of the West, Neil? And then give me your Stanley Cup champion. I mean, I'm gonna go with the Sharks, and I'm probably going to hate myself for it later. I just think, like I said, I think this is the year. I think we get the Sharks and the Bees in the final. And I'm going to take Boston, but I do think the Sharks get there this year. Give me your thoughts on that.
As much as I think that would be cool to see Thornton go up against his old team, I just don't see it happening. I think the Sharks are going to disappoint yet again, but I got some kind of feeling about the Blues. I don't know what it is, but I think that they can make a serious push and end up facing, Boston in the finals again. Because I don't want Philly anywhere near the Stanley Cup. I used to live near Boston, so why not? I'll take a little by proxy championship.
So we're both going with the Bruins, so we're just kind of chalk losers that just take the good teams. I think you're onto something with the Blues. I do think if there's a team in the West that is extremely dangerous, that is not the San Jose Sharks, I do think it's the Blues. But just something tells me, and I don't know what it is, and like I said, I'm probably going to be wrong. I'm going to hate myself in like 2 weeks when the Sharks are playing golf already, and I'm going to go, how did I get on the Sharks bandwagon again? I just think this is their year, man. They're getting good goaltending from a two-headed monster there with Niemi and Stalock. I like them. But we're both going to go with the Bruins, because that's the kind of guys we are. We are going to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, we might be joined by the fabulous Mike DePalma and the even more fabulous Scotty Brawl. We'll be right back with the Tri-State Sports Fan.
These days, my dollar just doesn't go as far. In my car, it gets me about 6 miles. On my cell phone, maybe 4 minutes. But at McDonald's, my dollar gets me through the entire day. From sausage McMuffin with egg for breakfast to a tasty double cheeseburger. Thanks to McDonald's Dollar Menu, my dollar gets me right where I want to be. Satisfied.
And we are back. And, Neil, you know what? Sometimes we sit here and we talk about it like we're not lucky, me and you. And, we'll say we're not lucky guys. We're not really that blessed in life. But I'm going to tell you who I have standing next to me right now. And it's Mike DePalma. He is back.
Hey, Neil.
He's here. I just want to hear you riff a little bit at some point about the Mets and how good Anthony Recker is. as well as this Chris Johnson deal, which I think puts the difference to people. But I want Mike to get on the mic. I want to hear from you. We've covered the golf of the Masters.
Yeah.
In the National Hockey League, and I know that probably upsets you.
I'm going to talk to you about the hockey just for a split second here.
Let's do it.
So I wanted your opinion on something. So Rangers are 20-1 to win the Cup.
Yeah.
That puts the money down.
That's what?
I figure UConn, I had a very casual UConn fandom this year, day one.
Yeah.
I couldn't be more casual of a fan than I am as a Rangers fan. So why not? Maybe this is just one of those years where my, like, pseudo teams that I, like, sign a root for, if you were to ask me who my favorite hockey team was, I'd say the Rangers.
Right.
Why not? 20-1, it's worth a couple bucks throw on it, right?
It's absolutely worth it, but I would inform you of this. Do you want to know who Neil and I both picked in that series?
Let me just ask you this. This is my... sounds stupid if I'm wrong about this, but were the Flyers the team that fired their coach after like three games this year?
They fired
and we talked about it, like, what could he have done wrong
in
the game? But it worked.
Yeah.
That just shows you where I went GM.
No, I mean, Neil mentioned it when we were breaking it down a little bit, and it is, and you know, we didn't get into it, but they fired Peter Laviolette, who's an outstanding coach. He's a Stanley Cup winning coach with the 06 Carolina Hurricanes, and
yeah.
I just think he stinks apparently. So they have Craig Berube on the bench. Berube was a lunatic during his playing career. And he's got this team, and that's what Neil and I were getting into a little bit, is they play a lot like he did. And they just come, they hit everything that moves.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of fun to watch, man. So I think it's a series, and Neil agrees that if Lundqvist can get hot, there's no question. If he gets hot, I don't think there's any question he's the best goalie in the tournament, in the whole playoff format. I just worry a little bit about the Rangers having a little bit of a soft kind of game that they've been playing. If I worry about the Flyers getting after it and just smashing them in the mouth for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And then seeing where the chips fall. But I like the Flyers there. But at 20-1,
well, let me ask you, because the other bet I was thinking about making. Well, you want to get back to it? We'll get back to the hockey. Because I want to ask you,
okay,
there's a bunch of prop bets for, like, you know, matchup wise. Well, I'm taking them in the dump, 50-1.
Right.
Probably still not good at it.
Sure. So
that's what I'm saying.
I do like that.
All right, well, let's get to something that I actually know a little bit about.
All right.
UConn basketball.
Yep.
Now, I'm 33 years old, so the early 90s is when I got, like, hooked. That's when I gave my heart to the UConn Huskies. So we're going to be joined now on the Tucci Lumber Hotline by one of the guys that really, to me, made this program what this program is and led to this dynasty that they've established. And that's Connecticut's own and current assistant coach at the Quinnipiac, Scott Burrell. Scott, are you with us? This is the second time we've had a little trouble with Scott Burrell, but hopefully we'll get Scott on in a minute. So Neil, let me ask you about Scott Burrell. As a guy from Jersey, Scott Burrell, I mean, in Connecticut, the guy's a legend. Well, are you familiar with Scott Burrell's work in the early 90s with the Take George teams and all, Neil, or what?
I'm pretty sure he's Pat the Bat's brother, right? Am I right or am I wrong?
I think it might be loosely related, but I don't think he's Pat Burrell. If he was Pat Burrell's brother, I would not, because Pat the Bat's a man killer.
No, I mean,
you want to know a fun fact about Scott Burrell, Neil? I know at the time he was, I think he still is the only athlete to be drafted in the first round for two different professional leagues. He was a first round draft pick for baseball, and then a first round draft pick after being in the NBA. That's pretty talented.
Yeah, I mean, it's better than Michael Jordan could ever pull off. So, I mean, props them for that.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, it's impressive. So, hopefully we're joined by Scott shortly. You know, for me, when you look back at, like, that, those early UConn, and maybe not early, because, I mean, Kelly would have been there a little while, but when you talk about the early 90s teams, that's when you started to see the, you know, Donyell Marshalls and Tate George and guys that are going to go on and play in the NBA. One of my personal favorites, Daron Sheffer, from back in that era. And I'm curious to get his take on, you know, if current UConn guys appreciate, like, basically the legacy these guys built. Because, you know, we talked about it at length last week about, you know, right now, that's the best basketball program in the country, bar none. And they really took it from a non-existent program 30 years ago to where it is now. And those are the building blocks to me. That was when they started going on their little runs, little mini runs in the early 90s. They started to really build on some things. So, you know, I'm just thrilled about it to talk to them. You know what I mean, though?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, as a former Net, New Jersey Net, I gotta give him some love. So, you know, the fact that he was, I'm curious to know about his time on the 97-98 Bulls. I think that's going to be really interesting to hear what the, you know, just inside the locker room, on the court, at practice, you know, what that must have been like. I mean, and to go on and win the championship is, you know, with front row seats, no less. So I'm curious, you know, it's interesting, the, the Charlotte Hornets selected him with the 20th pick in the 93 draft. The Toronto Blue Jays drafted him when he was a freshman at UConn. That's not as rough as I thought it would be. A Toronto-Charlotte split, he could pull it off.
Yeah, I mean, I think the most interesting thing about the UConn basketball program is that there's really two programs, and maybe you can make an argument for the Florida Gators as well, but there's really two programs that we've kind of seen from their infancy through to their greatness, and that's really Duke and Connecticut. And, you know, we've touched on it the past couple of weeks. I mean, Duke is the only one of those two programs that seems to get any credit. And you have Coach K with his four national championships, and you have Calhoun with three, and obviously Ollie with one now. And you kind of wonder, at what point does Connecticut get the kind of credit and attention that they deserve? I mean, I don't know anybody that goes gaga over Connecticut being the marquee 9 o'clock game on a Saturday night against, like, Rutgers or, you know, excuse me, Boston College back in the old Big East. But they really are on par with what Duke has built and what Coach K has built. Calhoun did the same thing. So, I mean, that to me is what I'm curious about in terms of talking to Scott Burrell is, like, are you guys aware of just how amazing what you've built is? Because sometimes when you're a part of something like that, I would imagine, anyway, you don't even realize that you're doing it. And like Mike alluded to, I mean, they were there laying the building blocks and the foundation for what is now, if not the best, most consistent college basketball program in the country, it's certainly among them. So you have the chance to talk to a guy who was right there at the genesis of that coming to be what it is now, which is just an elite basketball program.
Well said, Dan. I guess Neil's not going to respond to that. But I'm glad to see that since I in the 3 minutes and I've rejoined the show, there's just no kind of ebb and flow. It's just it's fantastic. Well, I think you hit it on the head. And I think that, you know, for UConn right now, and you look at, like, almost what they're doing in Quinnipiac, you know, obviously they got Coach Moore,
yep.
UConn pedigree. And then, they got Scott Burrell. It's like they're trying to build a little UConn mini down there in the MAC. So my next question to you, Dan, because you're going to be able to talk to this a lot better than I can, and hopefully we can translate that over to Scott Burrell, is the MAC. I mean, the MAC's got some – I mean, they're obviously a mid-major, but they've got teams there that it amazes me that really nobody from the MAC has made one of those miracle runs. Because they've got quality teams there. That's not a joke of a conference. You know, they've got teams there that you think, like, can Iona make a run this year, you know? Ryder, you know, back in the 90s was the team that used to come out and make it to the tournament every year. Can Quinnipiac, you know, if they become now, they have some coaches in there that can recruit. I mean, why do you think it is that the MAC really hasn't had one of those darling runs that some of the other mid-major conferences have had?
You know, to be honest, I mean, I think it's just kind of dumb luck where the team comes from. Mm-hmm. Because I can think back to Manhattan teams under Fraschilla, under Gonzalez, after that, who eventually went on to Seton Hall. I can think of a couple of those Siena teams under Coach McCaffrey that were really great. And obviously one of the greatest basketball players of all time, right from here in Norwalk, Connecticut, went to Niagara,
yeah,
which is a MAC school. So, I mean, you do have kind of that pedigree of some really, really good players being in that league. I just think the difference is Butler got hot at the right time or George Mason got hot at the right time. But I don't see really any difference between the run George Mason made with Jim Larranega and what Iona or Fairfield U or Siena or Quinnipiac could potentially do. I saw Quinnipiac was 20-12 this year, I believe.
Yeah, they were third in the conference.
Third in the conference, which is, you know, that's a very good record. And the thing that you'd like to know from a guy like Scott Burrell
are they going hard after Roy Kane Jr. from North Act?
Well, they should be if they're not. But you know what's always interested me? I've always heard, and obviously very few people are as good as Ted Williams, but they always said it was tough for him to manage because he was so good.
Yeah.
How do you kind of teach these
players? I think that all the time. A lot of these guys.
So you have a guy like Scott Burrell, who was an outstanding college player, first-round pick, goes and plays in the league for 7, 8 years, whatever it
was. Yeah, at least.
And now you're dealing with players, while I would love to be as good as they are at basketball, they are not Scott Burrells, generally speaking. So it's just a curious question in terms of what's it like to talk to those kids where you're like, you know, he doesn't have an NBA future.
Yeah.
But he could be a really solid, productive college basketball player at a mid-major.
You know what? Cool. I think that there are some guys that could do as much as can. I have a good story about Pete Tucci from Tucci Lumber, one of our sponsors,
right.
Former first-round pick, played in the Padres organization for a while, made a couple 40-man rosters, so was up for spring training. And he talked about sitting down and talking, hitting with Tony Gwynn. And Tony Gwynn not only, I mean, he was a great student of the game, and right then he was, you know, he you could tell he was going to be a coach, he said, which is surprising because he was so good. Then he talked about his natural talent. I don't know if I ever told this story to you or on the air, but one of the drills they do, they've got a jug gun, and the balls have a number with a color on it, 1, 2, or 3. And you have to say the number, 1, and hit the ball. And he says these things are coming in 90 miles an hour, 95 miles an hour out of a jug, which makes it, to me, harder. Because, you know what I mean? And he goes, you know, this is a first-round pick, Pete Tucci, you know, one of the best players ever to come out of Norwalk. And he was like, Mike, I was lucky just to be hitting the ball in that, with that setting. He goes, Tony Gwynn would be like mid-conversation with you. He's like, 2, great, to right field, or 2, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He said, like, his just God-given ability, which surprised me that he's, you know, he's a coach now. He's still at San Diego State, right? I know he had taken some time off when he had surgery and all. And so some people do, but I always hear this story about Ted Williams, and I always would think a good coach comes from a guy who couldn't play. You know, just or the scrapper type guy. I mean, Neil, do you know anybody like that? A guy that that was outstanding, you know, just athletically, but also can be a coach. I just think of some of the best players I've ever played with. I don't know many of them that are also going to correlate into great coaches. Neil, what do you think?
Well, we had this discussion, I think it was last year, 2 years ago, that with one of our fans that, you know, in baseball, catchers make the best coaches. You know, it's sometimes it's a bench guy, a guy who spends a lot of time in the dugout or on the, you know, next to the coach. You know, guys that really study the game as opposed to play the game, who make for the best coaches. So yeah, and you know, of course, there are coaches where they automatically command respect due to their athletic prowess, and I think that might be the case
with
Burrell, where it's like. That's just, you know, they don't even have to say a word. It's just their presence, you know, is able to get guys to fall in line. But to me, you know, and I think that's why Alnick is such a great coach, is because I was always the, you know, hanging out on the bench just watching stuff play out.
Yeah, I would actually think I'm surprised that more pitchers in general don't become coaches. Because you were just watching the game. I mean, especially relievers, to be honest with you. But most of the time you're sitting there, they're just out there, you know, BS and spitting seeds or Tobacco or whatever, not really paying attention. But, you know, you look at guys that are now currently being groomed to be coaches. Well, you look at Kevin Ollie, the perfect example of it. But then you look at guys like, as the later, towards the end of his career, especially there with the Mets, all they talked about with Alex Cora, this guy's going to be a coach. This guy's going to be basically a coach on the bench. And he was going to use a role player, played a lot of places, sat a lot on the bench. And instead of just sitting there being a rah-rah guy, probably plopped himself next to the head coach or the bench coach or did whatever and learned as much about the game as possible. So, you know, I'm also curious to talk to Scott about, like, when he started having these aspirations of coaching. And if he started towards the end of his playing career in the NBA, I know he went and played overseas, did he start to play the game with a vision of the coach? You know what I'm saying?
I think for every, you know, Lenny Wilkins or – Joe Torre, guys that were outstanding. I mean, Wilkins is a Hall of Fame player. Torre is a former MVP. I mean, for every one of those guys, there's how many other guys? 1,000 Alex Coras. So I think the numbers alone kind of lend themselves to these great players not becoming coaches. But I also think nowadays, with the amount of money these superstar players make, I mean, why are they going to go get into coaching?
Oh, I know.
Derek Jeter, when he retires, let's say he has a hankering advantage, why would he even want to go through the hassle?
Well, especially, that's why you almost have more respect, even as a Nick hater that I am, for a guy like Patrick Ewing, who has just taken this role. Like, at this point, he's been turned down for every time there's a head coaching job, people kind of throw his name out there. This guy's just an assistant coach for going on, what, 6-7 years now, banging around the league. Like, I mean, it's a pretty thankless job.
Didn't even interview Kareem Abdul-Jabbar from UCLA job. I mean, that's how, and he wants to coach. But, I mean, that kind of thing is amazing because, like I said, I think it's just a number game. For every Jabbar or every Ewing or every, you know, Lenny Wilkins, there's a million players that were not that good.
Yeah.
It's just the law of averages because those guys are among such an elite group of athletes. So, I don't know. I mean, whatever kind of athletes we were, imagine you're trying to coach a kid that you just know you just won't be able to do anything. I mean, where's the patience to stay with that? I mean, for a guy like Scott Burrell or a guy who was, you know, first round pick in the NBA, I mean, where do you summon the energy
to
keep working with those kids?
To me, and I wonder, it probably won't occur at the collegiate level. To me, when I coached 1 year travel baseball, and it wasn't, I mean, the kids weren't necessarily great. I mean, I'm sure none of them went to play college, but what frustrated me the most was coaching a bunch of 13 and 14-year-olds. And them just not caring about the game. Like, and I remember when I'm 13, 14 years old, all I thought about was my baseball schedule was hung up on the refrigerator. It's like all I cared about was, could I practice today? If I didn't have practice, can I go do something? That's all I cared about. And you know, the vast majority of the kids, I just played the kids that I thought really wanted to play because they just seemed to be having fun.
Right.
And then I remember the parents would be all over, why are you starting this kid at second base? I'm like, because this kid comes early, will come up to me, ask him questions, base running questions, and I just love coaching that kid. And the kid that was, like, just bigger than anybody because he's 13 and he's, you know, 6 feet tall, it just couldn't stand being there. I was just like, I couldn't deal with it. Neil, did you ever coach at any – did you ever coach anywhere, Little League, anything like that?
No, I mean, I attempted to be sort of a pitching consigliere slash consultant at Johns Hopkins my grad school year, but my studies – "quote unquote," distracted me from ultimately taking up that role. But it's something that I think now, you know, having matured a little bit, it's something that I can appreciate, and I would be totally down for wherever it might be. You know, because despite the reputation that us middle relievers get of being pranksters and jokesters and not paying attention, you know, we had guys like, you know, Mike Overstreet stealing signs. You know, so we definitely pick up on certain stuff, and you know, I think that you know, and bringing a different perspective to it, you know, yeah, I mean, yeah, you can pick up who the guys that aren't really into it or whatever, but sometimes I as a coach would rather discover the diamond in the rough, the guy that no one sees because he doesn't have the over-the-top skills or talent that's just blatantly evident to everyone. You know, I would rather see something developed from a guy that, you know, just needs the opportunity, you know, and just speaking from a guy that, you know, was hoping for an opportunity and got one occasionally and took advantage of it. You know, that those, to me, are the kind of players that I would kind of gravitate towards. But yeah, I mean, in terms of like a head coach, a manager, I don't think I could pull that kind of that off, but I could definitely be like a Jack Newell type to, you know, to rally the troops and kind of spark some motivation or the morale when everyone's kind of down from, you know, Babber's post game notes, which could be brutal.
Yeah. Coach Jack Newell, obviously a legendary assistant coach. I'm sure, you know, you've heard of him. Dan over at Johns Hopkins University, Jacksonian, just a legend in his own right. All right, well, while we wait to take care of our technical issues here with the phone lines with Scott Burrell, hopefully we'll get that straightened out. We'll get to them later. Let's talk about some baseball while we're sitting here talking a little baseball here. I guess the topic to talk about right now was supposed to be Tanaka Tuesday yesterday. It got rained out. He pitched today and just threw a gem, 10 strikeout, 2-bunt single performance. Granted, it's against your Chi-Town Cubbies. I mean, we all gave our predictions as to what we expected. Well, what we expected and what would be considered a success. I honestly think he's been better than I would have expected. You know, I know some Yankee fans were expecting him to come out there and have, you know, a sub-2 ERA and never lose a game and whatever. But the guy seems to just be ready to pitch in the major league from day one. professional pitcher, gave up a home run on his first at bat in the big leagues and just settled down, gave them length that game. He got into problems early on in his second start, gave them length again. I mean, this, to me, when we talk about the definition of an ace and I say, you know, talk about your stats, what, you know, at the end of the year, I want a guy who can give me seven innings and can keep me in a ball game, even if he gives up runs early, like CeCe was, you know, in the past for the Yankees. I think he's been everything you could have ever hoped for and more, Danny. What do you think?
Well, I think he has been more than I expected, but I would say a couple of things. Number one, it's the Cubs.
Yeah.
And until they're moved into the American League East and he can face them four or five times a year, I wouldn't be overly excited. I mean,
have you seen anything, though, that's like a red flag? Like,
I
was expecting more walks. I just always assumed.
I'll tell you exactly what I think, which is the more hate of him gets around to these guys, the more these big league hitters zero in on him. I mean, I'm not saying he's going to be a bad pitcher. I haven't said that once. I just said, you know, we don't know. He's on a lengthy contract, so, I mean, what he's going to be in 2 or 3 years, is it going to be Daisuke Matsuzaka?
Yeah, I don't know.
Or is it going to be an unbelievable pitcher? But I would just say, I'm not trying to crush Yankee fans' hope. It's the Cubs. The lineup stinks. They stink.
They had Olds. They threw out Olds.
I don't care.
He struck out three times.
Okay. And the other thing, just the more the film gets around, the more the scouting reports, the advanced scouting gets around, and he starts facing the Red Sox and the Blue Jays and the Tigers and all the good teams that he's going to see, it'll be more interesting then. But I'm not someone prone to getting excited, even if it's the kind of team I root for, until I see some kind of lengthy resume. Like, I'm not
ready to give him the
No, yeah. Your point, he's better than I thought he would be through, was it, three starts?
Yeah, here's what I think it surprised me a little bit about, because all we ever had was, you know, an inning here in the World Bank, whatever we saw of him internationally, some YouTube clips, and then you saw these scouting reports, and all everybody talked about was his splitter and his slider. And, you know, they said his fastball's fat in the low 90s, 90, 92 miles an hour. I think his fastball is much better than anybody hyped it up to be. And so that's why I was worried about him transitioning, because if you're going to be reliant upon a splitter, a starter, that gets old second and third time around through the rotation. People will just sit on it and wait for the fastball. So if you don't have a fastball, a splitter is very effective when you also have to respect the fastball. And you have to respect his fastball. He's got life on that fastball. I mean, Neil, have you watched him pitch at all? And is that, as a pitcher, is that kind of what you see? I mean, are you a little bit surprised they downplayed this guy's fastball? I think he's got a legit fastball.
Well, you know, you also have to keep in mind it's not the movement that you got on the fastball. It's not so much the miles per hour that you have on the fastball. So you could have a 90-mile-per-hour fastball, but you have a nice little dip or curve, a bend, something that throws off the hitter just by, you know, a little smidgen to get to prevent it, you know, a home run, turns a home run into a deep fly ball, a deep out. So, you know, to me, you know, because you look at guys like in the past, you know, I hate to bring up Parnell, but he's a guy that can throw 100 miles per hour, but it's right down the pipe, no movement, and, you know, major league baseball players can hit that. And I think that's why, you know, not to get off topic, but you're starting to see some success out of Henry Mejia, even though his walks are not where you want it to be. You know, his fastball, it's a almost borderline slider cutter every time, and that's just hard to hit. That's hard to adjust to. So, you know, I mean, like we said, it was the Cubbies, and I don't know that the Cubbies have much hope this year, but, you know, it's certainly, you know, you can't argue with his strikes-to-walks ratio. I mean, that's like, ideal, as good as it gets. And, you know, if he can keep up these kind of numbers, then the Yankees have a much better shot. I don't know that they still have enough firepower outside of him, unless, you know, Pineda's allowed to cover his entire body in pine tar every start, then, you know, maybe they have a shot. But I think Tanaka alone is not going to get this team to playoff.
Yeah, I don't think we need to make a bold statement about what this says about the Yankees or anything. And to your point about the fastball, when I say he's got a good fastball, I'm not saying he's got a 98-mile-an-hour, you know, Rosenthal fastball. But it's got movement, it's got late movement, and he spots it well. And I think a lot of times with a fastball, I mean, remember John Main used to get a lot of strikeouts with a fastball that wasn't necessarily overpowering. He was 93, 94 but it kind of had that rise to it, and he worked up in the zone. And, you know, you could be effective with your fastball, not necessarily with a guy that's a flamethrower. And I think the fact that he could sit there and say, I know I can command my fastball and get out with my fastball, makes all of his other pitches that much better. And I just – so surprised. It's not something that I heard a lot about. Everybody talked about a splitter.
You know, and I don't know how you two feel. I get so tired of the velocity argument. Just because, to me, the people that argue about velocity are people that never faced someone who throws over 75 miles.
Yeah.
I mean, really, because I'm sure you two would agree with this part. You'd rather face a guy who throws 92 in a straight and narrow than 85 and it moves all over the place like Maddux. I mean, so I understand your point, which is he throws hard, you know, hard enough with good movement. But then you hear people, and you know what? They just get on this velocity train, and you hear it around here. You got to see this kid pitch for so-and-so high school. He throws 90 miles an hour. You go watch the kid. He throws 84.
Yeah, I know.
And it doesn't move or whatever. So the deal with Tanaka, having seen some of the pitches he threw today, and I saw his last start, the ball does move. The ball does fail. And if you don't think it's difficult to hit a ball that moves that's not going that fast, then you never watch Greg Maddux pitch.
Yeah, right.
I mean, the ball has to move.
Yeah.
And his
it's about missing barrels. It's sort of
right.
It's about missing barrels. And so people in the major league level can square up a fastball.
Absolutely.
Anybody can throw it however hard. It's about deceptive. If it's flat, then you better be deceptive. I mean, I don't think Craig Kimbrell's fastball moves a lot, but he throws it from right behind his ear, and it just gets on you. Like Billy Wagner's fastball didn't move a lot, but it exploded at you. Even David Robertson's fastball, it's not overpoweringly fast, and it doesn't have a ton of movement, but the way his motion, he just, like, leaps towards the plate, and it's right on top of you. It's hard to explain unless you've been in a box. There's just some guys, it's like, oh, this guy's only throwing 88, but he seems like he's throwing 95.
Yeah, I mean, I watched Travis Wood pitch all last year.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a guy who's not going to break any radar guns. And he had, 165 strikeouts and 200 innings. The guy's ball as a left-hander tails away from hitters, right-handed hitters. He's got good off-speed stuff. And to me, I mean, he's far from a Hall of Famer, but he is the clinical example of a guy who pitches at the big league level without a plus-plus fastball.
Yeah.
And the people that just sit and say, well, you know, Joel Zelaya threw 98 miles an hour, and you go, well, where is he now? I mean, he blew his arm out, the ball. I mean, when guys would center that thing up, it went 500 feet.
Jordan Walden is a guy that's exactly – I mean, remember, Jordan Walden had the closer job in Anaheim a few years ago. Lost that job, and then he came over to I thought he was actually he's a guy that hit triple digits on the radar gun, but he just gets lit up, too.
Yeah. And
Darnell,
at that level.
Remember Daniel Bard? All we heard about Daniel Bard up in Boston. Is he even in the major? I mean, I know the Cubs signed him, didn't they?
Yeah.
Didn't that team sign him?
The Cubs do a lot of stupid things. But you know what?
He's not even cracking the Cubs bullpen. No. He's not in the bullpen right now, right?
No, they got Mr. Grimm out there. Just, you know, he's getting tired. But the thing about it is, I mean, people get so amped up about velocity, and I just wish it would stop. That's my complaint of it.
That's
night.
Music
stop.
That's music to Neil Lynch's ears. He was not known for an overpowering fastball.
No, but he probably had, like, my grandfather teach the drop ball. I mean, like, drop ball. My grandfather used to teach you the drop ball in 1935.
I mean, Neil, where did you used to sit where? Like, 83, 85 range? I mean, where was your fastball? It wasn't like, you know, you were throwing mush up there, but where did you sit? But you had movement and, you know, worked around. What was your fastball sitting at?
I was the hardest working man in middle relief, I'll tell you that much, Michael, because I used to use arm angles, deception. I used to slow down my windup on fastballs. I used to speed up my windup on changeups. I mean, you know, I was using every trick in the book other than, you know, the Pineda saw to get things done. So, I mean, I appreciate a guy who's willing to go the extra mile and you know, try new things and really, you know, just anything you can do to throw off the hitter is good because it's all about timing and getting a pitcher's rhythm down. And if you can throw that off in any way possible, it's art to me.
Can I ask you another question? Sticking with baseball but changing subject, how are the Mets above 500 right now?
Because they're playing the D-backs. I mean, the D-backs are just a train wreck at this point. I mean, they chased Bronson Arroyo, who's had their number for years. They chased him after, like, I mean, you know, they're getting – what sucks is that they lose Lagares and they lose Granderson. But then you have guys like Andrew Brown step up, Lucas Duda step up. You know, Nieuwenhuis comes from Las Vegas and decides to go yard. I mean, but again –
I've always been a Nieuwenhuis fan.
It's the D-bag.
This guy's got the power the other way. He's a big guy with speed. I always thought, I mean, he strikes out a ton. I always thought if you gave that guy 500 at-bats, he'd hit 260 with 20 home runs on bases, which the Mets haven't had that.
And they're getting nice production from the catching position.
Well, you're our resident Anthony Recker expert here. I mean, this is so obviously, Neil, you know that Dan played alongside Anthony Recker in college, so that's his best friend ever in the baseball world. And he talks about, I mean, Travis Darno started out the season 0-for-15 with like 8 strikeouts, and he caught the first 4 games. He's catching day games after a night game without Recker stepping in. Recker now has 2 home runs. He threw out Billy Hamilton a couple of nights ago, the fastest guy in the world. He threw him out stealing by a good margin. It wasn't a bang bang play. He had him dead to rights. What do we make of Anthony Recker? All we heard about is Darno, and the experts are saying the problem is they don't have a real backup catcher.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
To the 2 Mets fans?
Yeah. Get to Neil.
Forget Sandy Alderson in his psychopathy there with the 90 wins or whatever, but just talk about, to me, do you want to see Travis Darno play, or do you want to see Recker, if he continues to produce, play? Because your team that is likely not going to the playoffs, but do you want to see if this Darno thing works? Because I think the Dickey deal is already a great deal, just because the fact that Syndergaard looks like he might be good.
Yeah.
Why would you want to pay a knuckleballer $15, $20 million a year to be a knuckleballer when it's the most fickle pitch that you could ever throw? So you already have a kid that can catch a little bit. He seems like he can't hit.
And he's better than Coley.
Right, but you have Syndergaard, who looks like he could be something.
Yeah.
And now you have a kid like Recker, who's just hitting. Well, he's not a kid. He's 30, but he's hitting the ball out of the ballpark, and he's driving in runs.
Yeah.
And they keep sending Darno out there.
Here,
I don't get it.
I'll kick this over to Neil, but here's the only point I'll make. And Neil will appreciate this, being a Met fan like myself. The Mets are notorious for having very good backup catchers. Like Todd Pratt was their guy off the bench, came up with so many big hits, you know, and it was like, well, this guy could be starting in all these different teams across the league, but as a starter, he never would be that. Even Castro came up with a million big hits as the backup catcher. I just feel like maybe Recker's role right now is what he's suited to be. Now, you could be right. He could be a guy who, if he was given, you know, 135 games behind the dish, could go out and put up legit numbers and be a top 10 offensive catcher in the league. I don't know. But I get that sense that as a Mets fan, I'm happy with what he's giving us in that role. And I've seen it too many times when you ask one of these guys who's able to produce as a backup, as a full-time guy. Even John Buck last year, when he came in, he didn't come in as, I'm going to be the kid, but he played himself into the role and then faded away. Neil, what do you make of that? I mean, don't you seem to be like the backup catcher in the Mets is always the best player on the team?
Well, I think, I mean, you know, I think what, you know, Terry Collins is trying to, is getting better at, is playing the hot hand. And he's had issues with that in the past. You know, like if someone gets 3 hits in a game one day, he sits them the next day, and you're like, why did you do that? So, you know, you're starting to see that he's slowly changing that kind of philosophy, knowing that there's not one – the majority of the positions on the field for the Mets are not set in stone. I mean, you got Wright at third, and then you have, I guess, Murph at second, and then, you know, when they're healthy, Granderson and Wright or something like that. But all the other positions, if a guy comes in, hits 2 or 3, has 2 or 3 hits in a game, start him again. You know, what do you have to lose at this point? I mean – what the issue that I have with the Mets and Darno, it's like, you know, push aside that he's batting 150 something right now, because it, you know, okay, it's a bad slump, but I mean, what were you expecting to get out of him from this season anyway? I mean, was he really this guy that was supposed to hit a ton, or was he a guy that was supposed to call a good game and throw guys out like nonstop? You know, I mean, I don't mind platooning Recker.
Well, that's what
Darno
they sold us on.
I didn't
they
think that Darno.
This guy Darno was the best hitting catching prospect in baseball. That's all they talked about. This guy could hit 25, 30 home runs because he had 130 home run a season or whatever.
You know what confuses me is, I mean, the Cubs have a similar situation with Wellington Castillo, the young catcher that everybody needs to be. But I like and he's backed up by John Baker, who's a veteran, you know, had some good years with the Marlins and all those things, right? The Cubs aren't going anywhere.
Yeah.
If John Baker has a good start, why won't you? Why wouldn't you send him out there the next? I'd have no problem with that as a Cubs fan, because the other thing it does is if Collins, whether he's getting orders from above or not, if he continues to send out an unproductive Travis d'Arnaud, while the guys on the club know, you know what, geez, at least we put Rec in there. He can hit a ball out of the park or drive in a run or throw out Billy Hamilton or whatever. You start to send a message to your team, which is, we're not even in this to win. We need to see if this kid can develop. And that is a ridiculous message to send, first of all, for your starting pitchers.
Oh,
and that's their one day, and they go like this. You're giving me d'Arnaud, this lump of crap that's not doing anything? No, but I mean, and then they're looking at it like, why don't you give me Recker and give me a guy that he might go 1-for-5 with 3 strikeouts, but the one hit might leave the entire county because he hits rockets, and you keep sending d'Arnaud out there. Now, I don't think it's calm. I think it's an organizational that they say, you know what, we gave up a bolo, which they didn't, because I don't think you guys needed Dickey anyway.
Yeah,
I
no,
mean,
they didn't give
you
up
don't
bolo.
Give 5-year deals worth $75 million for knuckleballs.
Yeah.
And you guys should be thrilled.
Look how it's panned out.
Yeah, you should be thrilled that you don't have it. So you have a deal with a young catcher and a young pitcher that may pan out, but right now you have Record hitting the ball, driving in some runs, and you're sending a message to your team, which is we're not even in to win. We said 90 wins, which is a crock, but we don't even care about that. I think it's a horrible message to send, and not just because I know Record from back in the day, and he's a good dude and I like him, but just from a viewpoint of, I say the same thing about that. Now, dude is hitting. He had the 4-hit game tonight, which I stayed up and watched. You'd be proud to know that. Why didn't you just keep sending him out there? Just send him out every day. So he can't hit anymore.
Yeah.
And then change it up. Why does Ike have to play? Why does Satin need to sneak in if dude is hitting?
Yeah.
Put out your best players and give that starting pitcher that day, because it is his day, give him a chance to win with the best lineup you put out there.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think if you're going to win with a team like the Mets or like the Cubs, it's going to be about all these young kids are going to get hot, they're going to get cold.
Right.
It's figuring out when they're hot and to ride that hot hand, and then figuring out when it run dry and you go to the next guy.
You care if Record plays 5 days in a row if he's hitting?
No, absolutely
of course
not. Absolutely not.
Why
I don't know any real Met fan that does.
Why would
this point? Because exactly, at this point, what Met fans and what the organization should be thinking is, when they sold it to us, it's fine. They sold it to us with d'Arnaud and a young arm. Well, a year and a half later, whatever it is, what they now have is they traded him away for a stud young arm and a serviceable major league catcher who's got some upside.
And you know what? If he ends up stinking, d'Arnaud, and Syndergaard becomes the number 3 starter or number 4 starter, you guys win.
Yeah.
You win because you didn't eat a $75 or $80 million contract.
You become
you got a couple young guys.
You got 3 or 4. If he's a 3 or 4, and you're going to be able to get him at a league minimum for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And he's 3 or 4. He's not going to be a super 2.
Right.
So, I mean, it's almost like, so they're going to, you know, he's not going to be our arbitration eligible for 3 years, and it's going to be all the rest. I mean, I'm in lockstep with you on that. I just think that, you know, I like the fact that, you know, Newman Heights comes in as a big day yesterday. They play him again today. That's why. You know, I like that. It's horrible, Neil. I mean, how devastating was that Lagares injury? I mean, hopefully it's nothing big, but you know how hamstrings are. I know hamstrings are. Ruined my senior season. It's like, you know, those things can linger on. But, I mean, Lagares, we all knew that this guy could go out and get it as good as any center fielder in baseball. He was hitting 330. I mean, how devastating was that, Neil?
Yeah, it's brutal. And, you know, if we learned anything from the Jose Reyes era with the Mets, that hamstring is just it just refuses to go away, and it pops up at the worst possible time. So, you know, for me to put any kind of confidence in Lagares and his ability to stay on the field after that, it's tough. And then, you know, the fact that I wasn't expecting a whole lot out of Granderson, but the fact that you got to sit out with bruised whatever is kind of a major bummer. But you know, the backups that they've been putting in have been coming in and performing, so you can't complain too much about the injuries. And we'll see if, you know, it's just with Newman Heist, when he's off or when he looks bad, he looks really bad. He looks like he doesn't belong anywhere near a baseball field. So hopefully he's able to get over that hump this year and be that fourth or fifth guy that they can count on. But, just when things are going good, 2 steps back. 1 step forward, 2 steps back. Paula Abdul all over this plate.
Yeah, well, just one last thing about the Mets, and we've got to move on to my man Chris Johnson in a second. But
One last point about the Mets. I mean, I texted Dan, because Dan is the biggest Josh Staten fan outside of the Staten family in America right now. But they threw up a stat the other night when he was playing that last year among rookies with 200 or more at-bats, he was second in the majors in on base percentage. 376 on base percentage, second only to Yasiel Puig. And that's kind of surprising. I mean, he's a guy, I didn't realize he had 200 plate appearances to begin with last year. It didn't seem like he played that much. But to have a 376, you know, OBP is pretty good out of a rookie. The guy's been there for a little while. But, all right, we're going to go out to the phones real quick here. We're going to go out to line number two. We got Paul in Brantford, good friend of the show. Paul, how you doing, brother?
Hey, guys, how's it going?
Good. What you got for us, Paul?
I was just calling in tonight to call about the Jets. I'm a lifelong Jets fan. My dad's had season tickets since the late 70s, so I've been to about a million games. But I just wanted to call about that I was happy with the signing today with Chris Johnson, and also a little bit to defend John Idzik and the job he's been doing as general manager. I've actually been pretty pleased. I mean, I think the Chris Johnson signing is, you know, going to be very beneficial along with some of the other signings he's made. You know, obviously Eric Decker, and he got that Dmitri Patterson from Miami, who looks like a nice, speedy little defensive back. We need defensive backs right now. But I think just a little bit of, like, the philosophy of, like, being a general manager in the NFL. And I know a lot of Jets fans are Mets fans, so I think when free agency was kind of starting and it looked like the Jets were coming out of the gate slow and we missed out on some defensive backs and things like that and some other players that we might have gotten. But I was as a Red Sox fan, I've also, like, kind of looked at it a little bit differently as, like, the Jets fans who are Mets fans, because I was just kind of, like, looking back on the 2013 Sox, and I just always kind of, like, think a little bit about Moneyball. And I know a lot of times people, when they think about Moneyball, they kind of just think about it as, you know, sabermetrics and numbers and things like that. But I think one of the key themes in Moneyball that people always forget about is getting a player finding a player at a certain price where they're not appreciated for, you know, the type of money that they would be paid. In other words, a player that overperforms at the price that they would be paid. And I was kind of into Idzik all this time because, you know, he's from Seattle, from the Seahawks, and I think that they're a little bit into that, trying to find the bargain players that are performing more than what their salaries are. And obviously that was, we found that out when they blasted the Broncos in the Super Bowl. So I'm just really happy with, you know, getting Chris Johnson, and I'm kind of hoping, you know, this is going to be good for the going into next season between Vic and Johnson and Decker, and hopefully we find Sidney Rice. So I was just wondering what you guys thought about that.
Yeah, no, I agree with you completely. And you look, I mean, to be honest with you, the Patriots are kind of the money ball team of the NFL too, because they just have been able to fill in, you know, let guys go that they think are overvalued, the market's overvaluing them, let guys like Welker go and find other pieces. And I think I wasn't worried. I know a lot of Jets fans were super worried when all these guys, I mean, I was a little frustrated about Rogers Cromartie, but let's also be honest, Rogers Cromartie has been kind of a disappointment the last few years in the NFL. So it's not like we missed out on some lockdown guy. I think the Chris Johnson signing is great. I think I know it's 2 years, Paul. I don't know. I didn't see the dollar value. Did you see what kind of guaranteed money they gave him?
He's getting $8 million for 2 years, and I think he's got some kind of incentives where it could be $9 million. But I think for considering that whatever we were still under before the signing, which is like $29 or $30 million, to get him for, you know, that was for this year, $29 million we still had under the cap. But to get him for $4 million or $5 million this year, I think is a smart move. So,
absolutely.
Who else?
He's got the money to spend, and we all know the NFL, I mean, a 2-year deal is essentially a 1-year deal, depending on how the contract's structured, because you could just cut these guys, and typically, that, you know, whatever the roster bonus is going to be $1 million or whatever it's going to be for next year. I think exactly what they need. I really wanted them to trade for Darren Sproles, especially when you see what he went up going for a fifth-round pick. That frustrated me. But maybe Chris Johnson, who has shown some ability to catch the ball in the backfield, I think he's got
close to 300 career catches in his 6-year career.
Right, I was just going to say that.
A little guy. I think he could, and Marty Mornyweg likes a back that he could throw to. I don't think he really had one at his disposal like he could, you know, like he had hoped for. And what I thought of was, you know, when the Jets got LaDainian Tomlinson, it was like, oh, the Jets are just bringing some old retread in here. Well, LaDainian Tomlinson played a huge role with the Jets in his couple of years there, and gave much more production than I think anybody would have thought he would have. With catching ability out of the backfield, a couple little plays here and there. I think if you can ask this guy, Chris Johnson, to come in and have 15 to 20 touches a game, I think it'd be great. And to have that explosiveness there, well, I think it'd be great. What do you think?
Well, I also think just as a group, I've been going to Jets games since they were at Shea. I mean, I can't think of a backfield. I mean, this is, you know, it could be kind of a statement. Aside from, like, if you want to go back to some of our heydays in the 80s with, like, Freeland McNeil and Johnny Hector, or, I mean, aside from that, you know, it's pretty much like Curtis Martin. Just the, you know, the ground and pound, you know, chance that we have with, we have three backs now with Johnson, Chris Ivory, and Bilal Powell. I mean, if you can give the ball, I think, to Chris Ivory, you know, 12 to 17 times a game for, you know, a game to run, get the ball to Johnson 8 to 12 times running and catching. I mean, and then you have Bilal Powell, you know, as a third guy. I mean, I think that's a very deep and effective backfield that where all three backs all kind of do different things. And they're going to really help out, you know, both quarterbacks, depending on who ends up becoming the starter.
I agree with you. I think this is the way that the NFL is structured now. You want backs that can give you a little something different and can give each other a breather and stay fresh. I love the signing. The moment that I knew, you know, a month ago or whatever, when they, you know, announced he was going to be released by the Titans, I said, you know, depending on his price, and the longer it went, the better it looked for the Jets. This is a perfect fit because it's kind of a low-risk, high-reward type of thing. I think he's been humbled a little bit in the fact that there weren't teams out there clamoring for his services. I think he's a hungry guy. I mean, like I said, this is a guy, I think they said, I heard the stat that he's in six seasons, there are 96 potential games played. He's played 95 of them, started 93 of them. This is a durable guy for a little guy. Now, you might want to say, well, that means he's got a lot of wear and tear on his body, and there's a point to that. I mean, his production has dwindled a little bit, but I think he's still got just breakaway speed, and he's got that ability to just make a play out of nothing, which is exactly what the Jets need. But Paul, I was thrilled with it. I haven't met a Jet fan today that didn't like it, or at least was not, like, lukewarm liking it. I haven't met a Jet fan that hated it. So that's a rarity in Jetland when you find a move that the Jets make where everybody likes it. So, but I appreciate the call, brother. That's actually exactly what we're going to talk about. So it was a great transition. Keep listening, buddy, and it's always good to hear from you, Paul. Call anytime, all right, buddy?
All right, thanks a lot, guys.
All right, Paul, from Brantford, that was exactly what we were going to go to. Yeah, what did you make of it, the Chris Johnson signing? I mean, what's the downside of it?
Honestly, for the Jets, I didn't see any downside for that deal. I mean, I was looking at some coverage on it today, and, you know, for someone like me that's more into college football, I mean, they made it sound as though his career was completely dead. And then I saw his stat line since that 2,000-yard season.
1,000 yards every year.
1,000 yards every year, which, you know, for me, again, a guy not in the fantasy football deal, and I just kind of follow the Vikings and the local teams a little bit, you look at that and you go, what the hell wouldn't you be happy about?
Yeah.
I mean, and the other thing for me is looking at it as a Vikings fan, like, had the Vikings picked him up to spell Peterson, I would have been thrilled.
Yeah.
So why would you not be thrilled for the Jets?
Exactly.
I don't see any negative side to signing him for the Jets. I mean, Paul mentioned Bilal Powell, and I think, you know, I was listening to Herm Edwards talk a little bit today, and he was saying he loves the matchup between Vic and having a guy like this in the backfield in terms of the bevy of different kind of looks you can give a defense. With a quarterback that's mobile, with a couple of good backs, I don't see any downside to it.
Oh, that was a great move. I mean, Neil, are you going to shed some negative light on this, or what do you got for us on the Chris Johnson signing?
I mean, it's just surprising that the majority of people outside of Jets, you know, Gangrene Nation have been kind of down on the move, and it doesn't make sense to me. I mean, the guy is just so explosive and fast, and if you can just keep him healthy, the contributions he can make on the field. I mean, you got to consider where he was with Tennessee. You know, I don't know that he was necessarily happy there with the system, with the coaches, with the personnel. I mean, here's a situation where he gets to be in a major market, you know, playing with a team that has the potential to threaten. And, you know, we saw that they could compete and keep up with the Patriots last year when they had the right game plan and got a couple calls their way. So, I mean, it's a win-win for each party, and, it definitely makes the Jets more explosive. And this is what the Jets have been craving for a couple of years now. They thought they were going to get it with Santonio Holmes, but I don't think Chris Johnson is another Santonio Holmes. I really think that he's a guy that, if the offensive coordinator has any kind of, you know, wherewithal, can implement a whole, you know, series of plays, a whole package for this guy, because that's what he can bring. He can outrun linebackers, you know, out of the backfield on passing routes. To me, he's going to be more of an asset in the passing game than he is in the running game.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at his stats now, last year, which is supposedly the year of this huge down year, I mean, the guy averaged 3.9 yards a carry, caught 42 passes out of the backfield, 8.2 yards per reception. I mean, and that's in an offense that wasn't exactly an explosive offense. Not that the Jets are going to be explosive, but I think that they're moving towards that, that's what they're obviously what their end goal is. You get a guy like Decker, you get a guy like Vic, who's got a big-time arm. We don't know what his health is going to be through 16 games. He's going to give you something out there. Whether they add Sidney Rice or they add a guy with that first pick in the draft in the late teens, I think they're moving in that direction. I think you're going to get a lot of production. I think Jet fans are going to love this guy. But, Neil, let's take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to get to some duties serious. When we get right back, we have about 10 minutes to go on the show with the Tri-State Sports Guys. We'll be right back.
Is anyone out there? Nathaniel County Sheriff's Office. Is anyone out there? We were surrounded by the dead. They weren't rioters, what we were told. We have survivors here. Civilians, women, children. Is anyone out there?
Follow the story in the Ragnarok Rising Saga by D.A. Roberts. Available on Amazon, Smashwords, Barnes & Noble, and BooksAMillion.com. Visit RagnarokRising.Weebly.com.
Ragnarok clearly paid some big bucks this week because they got two commercial breaks, Neil. You got to like that. I do want to give us, speaking of sponsors, our good sponsors over at DeMotto Lawn Care, DeMottoLawn.com. Brian, the owner of the company, and another little baby girl, his third baby girl, he one-upped me. Little Lillian D'Amato was born yesterday. Gorgeous little baby girl. So we've got to give a little shout-out to Brian. Three girls, all under the age of six. God bless his heart.
God bless
I got two under
you
the age of three.
Get your lawn done.
Get your lawn done. The guy got three little girls.
Yeah.
That's a lot of little dresses,
yeah.
A lot of little bows to pay for. All right, let's take a quick call before we get duty serious. We're out the line. Ooh, we're going down to Philly here. We're going to go down to Philly here. Line number three, around the Tri-State Sports Desk. Who's this?
What's up, man? This is Gilly from Philly. Big fan, guys. Big
man,
fan.
Gilly, you guys are talking about the Flyers.
Well, here's the thought, dude. Everybody thinks Mason, he's injured. But I got news for you, man. Philly, he's got good numbers up against New York. And Berube did some good things. I thought playing Emery down the stretch is a good call because obviously you never know what's going to happen. And we played him actually three out of the last six games, actually some big games against Pittsburgh. And I believe he played the Rangers down the stretch as well. So it turns out this could be a huge series, man. Obviously, you got world-class Lundqvist on the other end. He's no slouch by any means. But it should be a good one, man. I think any fan of sports should be watching this series should be a good one. What are you guys
thoughts? Neil and I got into our Stanley Cup discussion earlier, and we both agree. We both like Philly in this series. And you know, I had alluded to the fact that I think Mason, certainly in the Eastern Conference, if not the entire National Hockey League, may be one of the most underrated goaltenders. He's not elite. I know they had him listed with a lower body injury, so it's typical NHL speak. But I said that, you know, when you look at guys like Couturier and Downey and Simmons, and the big bodies on the back end like Coburn that they have, and you know, Grossman, and Sprite's a good puck mover, I just think they have too much of that it factor for a Rangers team that is prone to playing a little bit soft. I had Philly in six games to win the series, and Neil and I both agree that the one thing the Rangers have more of than the Flyers is an elite goaltender. And so if Lundqvist can kind of stand on his head, do some remarkable things in between the pipes for them, he certainly can offset that wave of Flyer forecheck, which under Berube has been outstanding. I mean, wouldn't you agree that that's been the real story for them, is just the way they've upped that intensity under a guy who that's exactly the way he played during his playing days?
Absolutely. I mean, what I think he's done most is he shored up the D. They made a small minor deal, but it turns out it was huge with getting McDonald from your Islanders. And you gave me a scouting report on him, and been pretty much dead on, dude. Like he's been very good, man. And like, you clearly can't get a guy like Weber or a McDonough or that kind of guy, caliber defenseman, especially young guy, at the deadline. But he has been exactly as advertised. He doesn't try to do too much. He's out there, logs a ton of minutes, blocks shots, and he's been a big help for Shen. He was having a really rough year last couple of years, getting a lot of tough time from the crowd and everything, but I agree, man. I don't know, man. It's funny around here. People are really pretty nervous with the Rangers because we haven't won, I think, in eight games, I believe, in New York. So it's gonna be home team wins a lot of. You gotta hope that. I mean, at least I gotta hope Philly wins at least one in the first two. So it should be fun, man. I'm really looking forward to it. Big thing, I think, is the power play, man. If they're able to get to, I mean, they Rangers still have a very good penalty kill, and that's, I think it'll come down to special teams and goaltending.
Gilly, this is Mike. I got a quick question because we had alluded to it a couple times throughout the season and again earlier on in the show. I mean, the first week of the season down in Philly, as a big Philly fan, what was the mindset?
Yeah.
You fire your coach, everything was in shambles. I mean, were there still – I mean, I know up in New York, if that were to happen, the whole town would have turned on them. Were you Philly fans still optimistic that you'd be in this position now where there's talk you're going to move on to the second round in the playoffs or what?
I got to be honest, man. It's become, Philly's kind of a laughing stock of the league sometimes when it comes to, like, impatientness and, you know, they go out and do typical. They'll go out and, you know, draft a goon. It's like, guys, you got to move on, man. You got to get talent. You got to hang with the Rangers. You know, hang with these other teams. Like, you had to get talent. And you know, they still go out and they do these young. You know, they made that Richards trade. I mean, we're talking. You got Simmons there. You got Couturier. You got rid of Carter. I mean, you got a ton of talent coming back. And you got Shen. It's just. So you made some good deals. You're thinking, okay, you know, things are going smooth. But, three games in, they fire the coach, and you're just like, dude, how did you not – like, if you're going to do this, why not do it in the offseason? But, to Berube's credit, I think he steered the ship. I think he realized, you know, in order to really do well, you got to tighten up the D. And I think the team bought in, and – obviously, the rest is, so they say, history. I mean, we'll see. I mean, they got a long way to go before that. But I clearly think, I tell you what, that Boston series is going to be crazy, too. So we'll see. I'm not really – I don't really know what to think about this new playoff format, to be honest. But I'm willing to give it a chance. I think they're actually going to try it, like, a couple years and see how it goes. So we'll see.
You know, I'm not a fan of the playoff format myself, but before we let you go to get to a little doo-doo serious, I want to know two things. Number one, Hoosier Stanley Cup pick. We got a couple of Bruins picks here. And number two, on a scale of 1 to 10, how much did you like the Andy McDonald deal, the 6 years, $30 million that they gave him there in Philly?
I mean, that's a lot of money. But from what I hear, it sounds like in a few years that could be the average deal because it's apparently the salary cap's going up. But I will say McDonald, I mean, you feel like you're overpaying him, but the guy's, you know, he's pretty quality. I don't really think there's going to be a lot of free agents out there, so I think it's a good signing. As for Stanley Cup winner, I mean, it's tough. I know Philly can, if they can get past this round, they have a chance. I think they can beat the Penguins, but I think the true beast of the East, as you wrote on your column there on Tri-State Sports Size, I believe Boston is definitely the team out of the East. I think they got enough to win it all, but we'll see.
I agree 100%, Bud. I appreciate the call, and I will be rooting for the Flyers. I know that's not a popular thing around here, but I'll be rooting for you guys, man. Best of luck, and I will talk to you soon, buddy. Thanks for the call.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Philly. All right, thank you, brother. And Rangers and four, the lock. All right, Neil, you got like 3 minutes. I want a couple solid duty series to take us home tonight. All right, buddy, what do you got?
All right, let's go rapid fire. Jeff Francoeur, former Met, was tricked into thinking that a minor league baseball teammate was deaf for a full month. Go.
I saw that video. It was like a documentary they did on it. Have you seen this?
It
was one of the best 7 minutes. It's worth it. We got to post it to our site. I saw it on Deadspin. It's unbelievable. It was like it was a joke. So what wound up happening was there was like a ball got hit and almost hit one of his relief pitchers. And the coach and the Frank Cor goes to the coach. That guy didn't even move. And he goes, "Well, this is death." Like as a joke. And he goes, "Oh, I didn't know." And so he, the coach, tells all of his little players. And this guy went. His wife was in on it. They went out to dinner. They were bribing waitresses to pretend. And they were like, I'm not going to spoil it. It's an unbelievable story. For a month, Jeff Francoeur, a guy who was like a former All-Star, they're all around, Gold Glover, this guy got tricked for a month in the minor leagues of the San Diego Padres. His teammate was deaf, and he's a completely, like, giving an interview. It's amazing.
What a horrible thing to do.
What a horrible thing. And then they show him the documentary. That's how he found out. They showed him the documentary. Everybody, there's just one guy. Well, I don't know. He's never even in the major league. He's just going, what an idiot.
Yeah.
Every time they interviewed him. I mean, Neil, that was just gold, dude.
1 month is impressive as all hell. I know that when I was in college, our good buddy Mark Jarosz, who was a tall, lanky guy, had some cheddar on his fastball, once convinced me that I was his imaginary, that he was my imaginary friend. And that he didn't exist, and that I was imagining him the whole time. This is right around the time the Fight Club was coming out, so I was convinced. I was sold for about a week, but a full month is just banana pants.
All right, one more. What do you got, Neil?
There's a study that determines the fair market salary for college football players is $178,000.
It's a stupid study. I mean, how could you give like a blanket statement that every player is $178,000. That's what I don't like about it. I heard that. I think Colin Cowherd talked about it.
My understanding was it was an average taken from general profits of college football based on the 70 or so scholarship players have every team. If you think of it that way, then how much is a kid like Johnny Manziel worth or the quarterback at Notre Dame?
Yeah.
It's scary. I mean, you know, they should pay the kids I've always thought, so I'm not surprised to hear a figure like that at all.
Yeah. All right. Well, check us out every week, Wednesday night, 8 to 10 o'clock, TriStateSportsGuys.com. Check us out on Facebook.com/TriStateSportsGuys or @TriState_sports. Next week, we'll have more great guests. Hopefully, we'll get Scotty Burrell on one of these weeks. We'd love to have him call in. If not, we'll just keep plugging along. Thanks for listening. We're TriState Sports Guys.